Good morning, church. It's so good to see you and be with you this morning. I am so thankful to be a part of a congregation like Forest Mill that is not only a big part of the life of our community, but it's also planning for the future and the elders' decision to go forward with plans to fix this place up and make it a little more usable. I mean, things like restrooms, and we were walking around with the architects, and Elaine was telling them everything she wanted, and I was like, Elaine, we cannot do all this. But anyway, it was a good time. But they kept coming up with these ideas. I was like, we never thought about that. And I'm excited to see about some of the solutions that they've come up with. I'd never thought about some of the problems that they had posed. Like if a visitor shows up and they want to go to Bible class, where do they go? And I'm like, well, there's a lot of places they can go for Bible class. You know, there's about four different buildings they can go to for Bible class, depending on what ages they are and what their interests are, and how would they find them? I would just wander around and ask, I guess. We'd never addressed these before, and so trying to get a plan together for our members and for our visitors and for our community, I'm really, really excited about that. I'm excited about the time of fellowship we have today. I'm excited about the work that we have going forward. I'm really excited about it. And those of you who are Alabama fans are just giddy today anyway, because somehow you've suckered the SEC out of a chance at a national championship. So congratulations on that. So, so my sister-in-law is a big Alabama fan, my brother's wife. My brother is a big Longhorn fan, so I don't like them at all. And they were both celebrating last night their big victories, and I said, we'll just see who's celebrating tomorrow afternoon, because it'll probably just be one of you. It's been an exciting weekend on that front. I was thinking about, like, if you didn't do the job that you're doing, what job would you do? Sometimes I'll watch other people do things, and I'll think, oh, I wish I'd like to try to do that. And maybe that's just the way my brain works, but I'll see something and think, well, maybe I could do that with some training or some education or some practice, or maybe I could do that, or I think I'd like to try that. I'm thinking like that all the time. On the other hand, there's a lot of times I see jobs where I think, I would never want that job, right? I'll bet you've seen jobs like that. What would you say is your worst job that you've ever had? What did you do there? What was it that made your job so bad? What made that job the worst? This past week, I started doing just a little bit of research about what were the worst jobs in America by the way the people rated, the people who had those jobs rated them, and the list is probably about what you think. Taxi driver was right up there at the top. Retail salespeople, working in chicken houses is apparently not highly rated. Hotel housekeeping, people you think chicken houses are bad. People are way worse. Telemarketers generally hated their job. You can probably imagine a list of jobs that would just be really hard. One guy talked about how he was working in a warehouse. He just got out of high school. He'd taken a job in a warehouse. He was making $8 an hour, and his job on the assembly line was not difficult. His whole job was to take toilet paper out of one box and put it in another box. And he did that all day, every day. He said it was soul-crushing just standing there on the assembly line repackaging toilet paper. Another person worked on another conveyor belt sort of job. It was at a water bottling factory. And they would stand there every day, and these bottles of water would roll by. And it was their whole job to spot the bottles that weren't quite full. And when they spotted them, they knocked them off the conveyor belt, picked them up, dumped them out on the floor, and threw the bottle in the trash. That was their whole job every day. They said it was just like, it was terrible. For them, it was just the worst to stand there and do that all the day. Other people shared experiences about working jobs where they had particularly bad bosses, or or owners of the businesses who didn't care about them, or there were all these shady business practices or degrading treatment from coworkers or from customers. There are a lot of jobs out there that we don't want for a lot of reasons. The jobs that we might say would just, you know, suck the life out of you. Kids, stay in school. You don't want those jobs, right? So what is it that makes a job, on the flip side, what makes a job life-giving? Maybe something that you just love to do, right? Or maybe feeling respected by your coworkers or management, or working with people that you just like, you know, people that you like being around. I've had several different jobs in my lifetime. Some of them have been an absolute drudgery that I dreaded going to work every day. And it was before here I got here, probably. And some have been incredibly life-affirming, like I really looked forward to it. But nothing compares to the joy of serving others out of love, right? And as we continue our study through the Gospel of John, we see that the work of Jesus, what Jesus did on a day-to-day basis for the life, his life in the kingdom of God, brought life to everyone else involved. And we want to see what does work like that look like, right? So Jesus describes himself this way in John chapter 10, beginning at verse 10. He says, "The thief comes to steal and kill and destroy. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full." Life. Life that's not about a full bank account. Life is not about where we live, what house we live in, what community we live in, what nation we live in, or life is not about what party is in office, or what team is winning, or what grades our kids are making in school, right? Life is not about any one of those things, because all those things can divide us. What Jesus says is that life is the thing that comes from one unified person, him and him alone. But here's the great lie. Here's the great lie that's out there, the great deception that our enemy weaves into our lives. He convinces us that if we just had something else, and maybe it is more money, or he says, if you just had, you know, more money, boy, then life would be perfect. Or if you just had a better spouse, or a different spouse, or another spouse, life would be perfect. Life would finally get easier. Or if you had the right influence, or the right recognition, or the right amount of power, or any one of a number of other things, if you had those, then you would have life. But it's always a lie. Our nation is the richest nation in the history of the world. Now, let's look out across our country. Does our country have more life than any other place? Do we have better families than anywhere else? Have we eliminated poverty and hunger in our country? What about crime? What about rates of suicide? If we have so much life, why is there so much wrong, right? Or maybe if you're a particularly political person, you think if the right political party had more power, then everything would be better. But opportunities to receive life from Jesus cannot be governed or legislated by the state, right? The earliest Christians, they lived in a really anti-Christian state, and yet they were joyfully laying down their lives in the most hostile political environment that we can't even imagine it, right? It's not even to be found in the right nationality. Don't get me wrong, I am very thankful to be living where I live and in the era that I live in it. But the nation of China now leads the world in sending missionaries despite all of their national laws. Over and over and over again throughout the history of the world, the kingdoms of men have proven their trustworthiness to give us life. They tell us they'll give us life. They promise that they'll give us life. Yet time and again, we place our hope in them despite them letting us down, right? Even if we go all the way back to the Old Testament, God had this ordained system in place. He appointed leaders, specific people, to lead his people. And what happened to them? Well, eventually, he says every office in the land was corrupt. In the book of Ezekiel, chapter 34, God deals with this. And this is really important for our passage today. It gives the background to what Jesus is going to say later. So God had enough of all this, and God says to the people, he says, "Son of man," talking to Ezekiel, "prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy to them and say, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Woe to you, shepherds of Israel, who only take care of yourselves. Should not shepherds take care of the flock? You eat the curds, clothe yourselves with the wool, and slaughter the choice animals, but you do not take care of the flock. You have not strengthened the weak, or healed the sick, or bound up the injured. You have not brought back the strays or searched for the lost. You have ruled them harshly and brutally, so they were scattered because there was no shepherd. And when they were scattered, they became food for all the wild animals. My sheep have wandered all over the mountains and on every high hill. They were scattered all over the whole earth, and no one searched or looked for them." God's message is clear. He entrusted these men to look after his people, but their primary goal was not to look after the people. Their primary goal was to look after themselves, right? Have you ever been around someone like that? A boss or a manager or a company you worked for, or maybe you've seen an athlete on a team who seemed like they were out for number one, or a politician who says one thing in public and yet in private they seem to scheme everything towards themselves, or a famous person, a celebrity who does something like that. What's it like seeing or being around people who are like that? What's it like, particularly when they're close to you, to be led by someone who you know doesn't care anything about you, that they're just using you for their own benefit? Well, we might describe that as soul-crushing, mightn't we? Life-sucking, we might say. So what was God's solution to this particular problem? When the leaders of his own people behaved this way, behaved just like the leaders of the people who were not his, that you couldn't tell the difference in the way people who didn't know God at all, the way they treated those they led and God's people treated those they led. How does God intend to deal with this terrible, soul-crushing problem? Is he going to make new and better laws? Is he going to get rid of the old leaders and bring in some new, fresh blood? That's not what God says he's going to do. Later on in Ezekiel 34, he says, "For this is what the sovereign Lord says, I myself will search for my sheep and look after them. As a shepherd looks after his scattered flock when he is with them, so I will look after my sheep." God himself promises to be the shepherd for his sheep. They've been abused, they've been neglected, they've been shunned, they've been rejected, they've been refused and confused and deflected, but God himself promises he's going to straighten it out by becoming the shepherd himself. So when Jesus comes to live on earth, when God is made flesh and dwells among men, this is what Jesus says in John chapter 10. "I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep, and my sheep know me. Just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, I lay down my life for the sheep." And then just a little bit later down, he says, "The reason my Father loves me is that I lay down my life only to take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have all authority to lay it down and authority to take it up again. This command I received from my Father." So here's the lesson in a nutshell, if you're just wondering what this is all about. Real leadership, godly, truly godly leadership, in its essence, is laying down your life. It's the exact opposite of self-interest. It is making others better. It is lifting them up. It is giving them your strength. What makes the work of Christ so life-giving for us is that we're working for a God who willingly laid down his life for you, so that you, in turn, could willingly lay down your lives for others. And that makes even the most difficult job rewarding in a way that power or money or accolades or fame or fortune, rewarding in a way that none of those things can. Our society doesn't believe that. We don't. We say that, you know, if you paid me enough money, well, I'd do that. Right? I'd do that for $1 million or whatever the number might be in your head, because we believe that even terrible work would be okay if we got the right reward. But God says, no, that's not the way of my kingdom. So it should come as no surprise then that we look out at the jobs that people report the highest levels of being rewarded in their work. It should be no surprise that the number one factor in people saying a job is rewarding is not how much it pays or what the hours are or where it is. The number one factor in determining whether a job is rewarding is a chance to make a difference for others. That's the number one factor. So jobs like speech and language therapists, they find their jobs very rewarding. Working for a charity that you believe in, very rewarding. Rehoming pets, as dirty as that job would be, very rewarding. Even childcare, which I think you could not pay me enough to do, but childcare, or even teacher, and those are terrible jobs, right? Not because those jobs are easy or because they make a lot of money or because the hours are great or because everything goes smoothly or because everyone supports you or anything like that, but because you get an opportunity to inspire, an opportunity to make a difference, an opportunity to give life. The difference that Jesus makes is that he demonstrated good leadership, godly leadership, and that it's not just about self-promotion, it is about self-sacrifice. And that's the exact opposite of the message you'll get from our culture, from our world. Because God is the sort of leader who came to give his life, not to take yours. That the way of life he offers, as difficult as it's going to be, will bring real life, true life, to both the giver and the recipients. And a good shepherd like that makes all the difference in the world. I don't know about you, but I'm blessed to have a family who loves me. I've got my physical family, my wife and my kids, my parents, I've got extended family, but I've got a spiritual family who loves me. I've got friends who support me. And that makes even the hardest of days bearable. Doesn't make it easy, but it makes it bearable. And if I know that I'm doing the work that I've been called to do by God, that I'm living into the life that Christ gave, it makes it rewarding no matter the difficulty. So my prayer for you, my prayer for us as a congregation this week is that we might be the sort of sheep who grow up to bring life to those around us, that we emulate the life of the Good Shepherd and lay down our lives as well. And if we can encourage you this morning, lift you up for prayer, for forgiveness, for strength, for encouragement, whatever it might be, or if you are ready to take the life of Christ and lay down your own life to have your sins washed away and rise to walk in that new life, won't you come now as we stand and as we sing?